Money Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual. Do great things. My name is Arabile Kumete. Standing in for Bruce this evening from Bloomberg News. The big, big news, of course, the downgrade by Standard & Poor's coming through today, announced just moments ago, around 17:40 to be exact, around 20 to 6. A big news story there, non-investment grade, or as we like to call it, junk status for South Africa. The first time since the year 2000, the company itself, Standard & Poor's, saying this is all just purely based on political uncertainty, which has clearly driven South Africa's conversations as of late. We have seen a cabinet reshuffle, of course. It's one of many that President Jacob Zuma has done. He hasn't, there's only 2 years in his entire administration where he hasn't had a cabinet reshuffle. That was supposedly in 2009 and 2016. Of course, every year since then, we've had some sort of change in his cabinet. That's 17 years since we last were in non-investment grade. We had thought that things were getting slightly better, but aren't now. BB plus for South Africa, which is the highest junk score, or just one level below junk status now. And South Africa then warning that deterioration in the nation's fiscal and macroeconomic performance could lead to further reductions. That's according to the latest Bloomberg story there. The local currency rating reduced then from what was triple B minus. We're going to get some reaction to all of this news in just a bit. Of course, we were set to have the finance minister, Malusi Gigaba, who is now in his fourth day in office, two working days that is, but fourth day as the finance minister. He has unfortunately cancelled with the downgrade itself requiring his urgent attention. We'll hopefully get some more out of him, hopefully at a later stage. A lot coming up on the show as well, but for now, let's deal with the downgrade.
The Money Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
Nedbank economist Isaac Mashego joining us on the line. Isaac, not unexpected news, though, is it?
Well, Arabile, this is, you know, shocking. This is so depressing. This is exactly what we've been warning about. You know, what is really worrying is that S&P has maintained a negative outlook, which simply means that there's a 1 in 3 chance that a further downgrade could come through. Usually, you know, they look at a year to an 18-month period. So this is very worrying. I mean, clearly, the changes in cabinet triggered this.
Yeah.
The statement is quite clear. You know, the fiscal path that the National Treasury has been on of keeping growth in expenditure under control, of keeping the increase in government debt under control, is under threat. You know, there is this talk about radical economic transformation, which unfortunately is not very clear what it means. And what we need is macroeconomic stability. Even in the ANC's economic transformation document, it talks about maintaining long-run macroeconomic stability, even though we are pursuing inclusive growth and we want employment growth. So this radical economic transformation, I can tell you, it just adds to the policy confusion that we've seen with the South African government over the past few years.
So that would make note then of the fact that, you know, the likes of the ratings agencies themselves have said that it doesn't really matter who's at the helm of particularly the finance ministry. What they're worried about is policy continuation. And does that radical economic transformation agenda then set the tone that policy is definitely moving in a totally different direction?
Absolutely. That's the big fear. Because, you know, we have to bring down that budget deficit so that we can keep the increase in government debt and also debt service costs under control.
Yeah.
For the fiscal year, which starts today only, the government has budgeted 162 billion rand just to pay off its debt. That absorbs more than 10% of the 1 trillion in revenue that we had today that SARS has collected. Now imagine a situation in which government, out of the 1 trillion plus that SARS has collected, cannot utilize 10% to deliver services, to grow this economy and all that. That is why we keep on stressing that debt has to be kept under control, and we cannot keep seeing that ratio as a percentage of GDP keep rising to 50% or more of GDP. You know, that cannot happen. It simply means that we are going to see more tax increases, for instance, for individual taxpayers, because that's what we've seen since 2015.
Yeah.
In 2015, we saw marginal tax rates going up. We saw the capital gains tax going up. This year, no relief for bracket creep. Very little, adjustments of the brackets. And again, now we also saw, for instance, the dividend tax going up. So these tax increases are just going to be piled on the taxpayer, and we have an extremely narrow tax base.
Yeah,
and
2%, a 2% fall then in the rand as well. Thus far, 13.70 against the US dollar, 14.60 against the euro, and 17.09 against the British pound. Earlier this afternoon, the finance minister himself, Malusi Gigaba, said he doubts that a change in personnel would mean that South Africa gets a downgrade. I guess the answer to that has sort of been given here. How much more work does he have in store?
Minister Gigaba has got a lot of work to do. He's got a lot of work to do. I believe that he started on a very wrong footing, you know, just adding to policy confusion. This radical economic transformation is not well defined. We have to address the very uneven ownership of the economy. You know, we have to make sure that growth is more equitable. We have to lift this economy to ensure that its capacity to create jobs is increased. But of course, he did not really pay attention to all those. What I heard from them was just about radical economic transformation without really going out of his way to say that this is how we will do it, and we will balance it with macroeconomic stability, which, by the way, is in the ANC's economic transformation document.
Isaac, thank you so much for the time. We're getting more reaction on this. That's Isaac Mashego, economist at Nedbank. Cas Kuvadia also joins us on the line. He is the CEO as well of Banking Association South Africa. Cas, thank you so much for the time. Your reaction to the news?
I wish I could say it was a pleasure. Look, we in our statement after the cabinet reshuffle, we warned that this actually erodes the reshuffle and the way it was done particularly, and the fact that that capable minister and deputy minister were fired while incapable ones were kept raised all sorts of questions.
Yeah.
We warned that it erodes confidence, it actually creates policy and political uncertainty, and that it might force rating agencies to review us, and this is what's happened. So you know, we shouldn't be too surprised. And what this tells us is that we work in a global economy and we trade in a global economy that has no sweetheart. South Africa has not a sweetheart.
Yeah.
And they take hard decisions based on facts and conditions that they see in particular countries. We're now at junk status, and we're going to have to come together as a country with the appropriate policy certainty, confidence to actually get out of this.
Yeah.
And that means that the president needs to understand that what a lot of people have been saying, that his actions were not in the national interest. Well, now we know it's not in the national interest.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, this was taken into account at all? I mean, this really fares very badly for your constituency, the banks, that is, as well. Borrowing costs themselves are said to go up. South Africa lending from international investors, that's bound to be a little more risky for them, so they're not going to lend to us. Do you think any of this was taken into account when making that cabinet reshuffle?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't with the president when he decided on the cabinet reshuffle.
Yeah.
But one would think that these were and these were things that all of us have been warning about for many months. We warned about this at the time Minister Nene was fired. We worked for 16, 18 months through the CEO initiative with the previous minister, deputy minister, and an amazing national strategy team to actually avoid the downgrade for 16 months. And then in one fell swoop, unfortunately, all of that just gets eroded and turned back. So this is, I mean, what does this do? Increases the cost of money, people wanting to borrow from banks will pay more. And ultimately, it had an impact on inflation, had an impact on our reputation. And ultimately, who are the people who suffer the most? It's poor people who have very little choices and very alternatives, very few alternatives.
Yeah.
And I think that you know, this just unfortunately shows that we have a leadership in this country that just does not put national interest topmost of mind.
Yeah.
And it's a sad day, and it's extremely problematic, obviously, for the banking sector. To a certain extent, it may be factored in. We saw bank shares lost 86 billion rand on Friday. So, you know.
And they're losing more even today.
And they're losing more today, and the rand is in free fall. So, you know, you take certain decisions, and they're not well thought out. There are consequences to them, unfortunately.
Cas Kovadia, Managing Director at the Banking Association of South Africa. As he says, there are decisions made in South Africa that have led to this, of course, an expected increase then in the South African interest rate situation. That might change as well. Some analysts were expecting a much rosier picture out of the governor, Lesetša Kganyago, last week. But after having seen where the rand went and a lot of political instability, we then perhaps saw what was a little more cautious picture painted by the Reserve Bank governor. And this situation itself may force his hand a little bit as well. This is the rand's worst weekly slide since December 2015. Despite the fact that the dollar hasn't done too much to help that situation either. Colin Coleman, who is the head of Sub-Saharan Africa at Goldman Sachs, told Bloomberg that Zuma has been playing Russian roulette with our investment grade rating through his actions, as he had said in an interview with Bloomberg as well. So that decision itself coming through all of this. Gigaba, the finance minister, had also said that a downgrade wouldn't be permanent. That's what he said earlier this afternoon. So certainly we hope to see whether this will be permanent and whether others are going to follow. We still have Moody's, who is scheduled to release their announcement as well this Friday. Fitch doesn't adhere to a particular calendar, so they don't have to release at any point in time as well. They can just decide and choose. Mark Kingdon, who is the group executive for operational support at the South African Revenue Services, you know, we were scheduled to talk about the more than 1 trillion rand that you've collected in the 2016-2017 financial year. But a quick question from you regarding this downgrade. Does it make your job harder?
Well, obviously, Arabile, and thanks that we could just chat. Obviously, any aspect in the economy makes our job tough. I mean, the economic growth currently sitting what around 0.5%, that makes it tough. So anything that adds to that would make it tougher. But we as a revenue service will do what's expected of us and do our damnedest to collect what is due to the state.
Yeah. How much more work do you think there needs to be done just by SARS to collect what is necessary? I mean, already tax morality might become an issue just because of the changes on an executive level, shall we call it that, with the finance minister and his deputy. How much more then, more groundwork then needs to be laid out in order to ensure that, you know, the figures don't drop off below the 1 trillion rand mark?
I think, Arabia, the key thing for us is to make sure we do our job well. And that includes that we get the money out to the fiscus and enable trade, which is part of our job, out to the market. So VAT refunds must flow on time and all of those good things. But at the same stage, we need to collect the debt that is due to the state, because our debt book is quite significant and there's quite a lot of scope to collect additional revenue from that. And we need to do our best to collect it from that as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's a tough ask, but that's what we're there to. And we've risen to the challenge before and we'll rise again.
Okay, well, how about we talk about this now, Mark? You've had a collection in revenue of just over, or an increase rather, in revenue collection of just over 8%. That's between 2015 and 2016. In the last one, between 2016 and 2017, you've now seen 7%, according to the data you've released then today.
Correct.
And you're hoping then for a 10.5% uptick that's heading into next year.
Yes, that's correct. And obviously that is built on a number of factors, including an upward swing in terms of economic growth, which was predicted. So obviously that's got to be factored in, and these are the things that impact our collection. Yeah. Because if there's economic growth, obviously more tax is due, obviously.
Having taken this into account, the downgrade having happened now, do you think there should be a revision to that figure? Because I'm sure that that estimate didn't take into account a downgrade.
It's nice for me to state that that's above my pay grade, because it is. I mean, this has literally happened while I've been waiting on the phone almost with you. So obviously I've got to defer to my more experienced economic colleagues in terms of that regard. But ultimately, the Minister of Finance has got the prerogative in terms of setting a target. And in terms of the medium-term budget statement in October later this year, that target can either be revised downward or upwards.
Yeah.
But that is in the prerogative of the minister.
Taking into consideration refunds, SARS collected 1.144 trillion rand in the 2016-2017 financial year. There was great concern, however, in reaching the numbers. The deputy minister making note of that as well at the press conference today, saying, you know, that they were concerned whether they'd be able to reach these targets. It was a big concern. Does that mean that the political fracture between the commissioner and the previous finance minister, Pravin Gordhan, constrained the ability to collect taxes?
I really think you're asking me to comment on something that is outside my scope. But obviously anything that negatively impacts is always adds to the woes. And the commissioner spoke in Parliament last week that some of the negativity obviously does make our job harder.
Yeah.
That is a fact, but I think that type of question needs to be addressed elsewhere.
All right. And what do you think then the new tax bracket does? Does that help your revenue collection?
Obviously. I mean, if you take a person earning above where the 45% now kicks in, it would. There's always fear, of course, that people could, try and not pay. But that makes it all the more important for us to ensure that our systems are in place to ensure that everybody pays their right portion.
Mark Kingdon, Group Executive for Operational Support at the South African Revenue Service. Thank you so much for joining us amid the breaking news, of course, that South Africa has been downgraded to non-investment grade. That's double B plus with a negative outlook. This afternoon, that happened just after the market closed at 22.6.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Well, till now, we still haven't had any response from National Treasury regarding what has just happened today. If you haven't heard the breaking news that Standard & Poor's has downgraded South Africa from investment grade, that was triple B, to a non-investment grade, or as we like to call it, junk status. Not a good move for South Africa. The rand dipping to around 13.70 against the US dollar. So bad news on that front. But we're joined by Graham Bell, strategist at Old Mutual Investment Group. Before this happened, I was going to ask you how close we're trading to non-investment grade. I guess that question's out the window, isn't it?
Hi, Arabila. Today was actually quite a good day in the market. And even the interest sensitive stocks like general retailers, property, banks, those kinds of stocks had actually sold off earlier in the day, but we traced quite a lot of the losses.
Yeah.
And a couple of them actually ended up back in the green. That was before, obviously, this announcement came out.
Yeah.
And the rest of the market moved ahead quite strongly. I think this is a very disappointing result, but not unexpected. And in fact, Conrad Royce of Standard & Poor's several times last year indicated that the line in the sand was drawn around Pravin Gordhan, and if Pravin was to go, and certainly in circumstances like this, that they wouldn't wait until the official announcement in June. They could quite easily convene a rapid meeting and make the decision, and that's exactly what they've done.
We saw banking shares continue their fall as well, even today, even obviously earlier before this announcement was made. This is bound to continue, isn't it?
Well, the banks were only slightly off at the end of the day today, and there was some hope that things were stabilizing, but certainly this has got to aggravate the situation for the banks and other interest-sensitive sectors as well.
Yeah. But not everything is doom and gloom, though. Resource stocks, especially gold counters, are up today. How much of that is based on the rand's fall?
Well, the gold and platinum stocks are particularly sensitive to the rand because they're pricing in the Rand platinum price and the Rand gold price are important. And with the Rand having been so strong in the last few months, the Rand platinum and gold prices have been coming down. And that's a big problem for these miners, because they have costs that are tending to go up all the time. So, yes, today is a good day, and very much in inverted commas, for the miners. Also, because the general miners, like the big mining stocks like BHP Billiton and Anglo American and Glencore and so on, are also stocks that generate dollar revenues. If the Rand weakens, then they get a bit of a fillip as well.
Yeah. Market movement for tomorrow, what do you expect?
Well, I don't forecast day-to-day movements, but I think it's a bit of a no-brainer that's going to open pretty negatively. We don't manage our clients' money on the basis of what's going to happen the day after. But I think that it has to be negatively felt. I think the gloom and doom that started on Thursday night continues, and until we get some sort of clarification as to exactly what the new finance minister intends to do, people are going to remain extremely nervous, and the volatility will remain.
As you say, finance minister is awaited with a comment of any sort. Malusi Gigaba's job just got harder. Graham Bell, strategist at Old Mutual Investment Group, there as we talk markets and money. But for now, let's get into that breaking news. Tara Penny.
Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
So in today's Fast Fact, I asked you who Kevin Johnson was. And of course, the Fast Fact is brought to you by MTN Business. To protect your business, visit mtnbusiness.com/ZA. Who is Kevin Johnson? Well, the new Starbucks CEO, with Howard Schultz stepping down as CEO, of course, Johnson is taking the place of a man whose name has become synonymous with Starbucks over the last 30 years under Johnson's leadership. Now, of course, as I said, Kevin Johnson, the new Starbucks CEO. They've rolled out quite a few stores themselves here in South Africa. Howard Schultz stepping down now as CEO of Starbucks. Earlier in today's Fast Fact with MTN Business, I had asked you that question. But of course, here are some more Fast Facts with MTN Business. MTN Business understands the importance of protecting what helps your business grow. That's why they're the ICT provider with end-to-end security solutions. MTN Business cybersecurity includes vulnerability assessments, IT network security, email security, firewalls, and mobile device security. To protect your business, visit mtnbusiness.com/ZA. If you know your Fast Facts, remember to join me for the MTN Biz Quiz on Friday, where you could win 2,000 Rand in cash.
The Money Show,
your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual. Do great things. My name is Arabile Kumete. In for Bruce Woodfield. The next Money Show, I'll have Magda Versiska in studio to talk about the science of business activism. Find out what this opinionated CEO believes business must do in response to the cabinet reshuffle, which has obviously then led to a downgrade in South Africa's credit rating. Also, Andy Rice with your advertising hero and zero. All this and more on your next Money Show.
Call us on 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567.
We are indeed taking your calls on exactly what has just happened. S&P downgrading South Africa to non-investment grade about an hour ago, exactly to the time, saying, of course, that political instability in South Africa has forced South Africa to be downgraded to this level. S&P credit analyst Ravi Bhatia saying that the statement itself is forward-looking when it comes to South Africa. They are commenting there on Bloomberg TV. So they are speaking, of course, about just what has happened in the story. South Africa itself seeing the Rand go down, even breaching some levels that we haven't seen for a while, but not the worst breakout. If one has to consider exactly what happened when Nhlanhla Nene was taken out of office, of course, in December 2015, and what we're now calling 9/12, of course. Martin in Sandton on the line. How are you doing?
Well, and you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah.
You were speaking to Mark. I didn't get the surname from SARS and telling
Kingdon,
us about
yes,
the
Kingdon.
Yeah, to get the duty of SARS to collect all the taxes.
Yes.
Etc. And I'm sure most citizens who pay tax have no objection to paying tax, and it's an important thing. But I think SARS's duty is not only to collect tax. I think they owe the citizens of this country, especially the poorest of the poor, to see that that money is spent appropriately and not on the corruption that we see. The huge amounts of money that SARS collects that are just wasted, the bailout of SAA, the people that are put in charge of this, the Prosa debacle,
yeah,
has cost billions and billions of rands. And that's why students are rioting. They've got to pay for their tertiary education. All of this could be taken care of. And I think that's where they lose it. SARS just thinks their duty is to collect tax and not worry where the money's spent. And I think what's going on here, us going to junk status, now SARS is going to have to collect the tax and pay more for the interest on the loans that we have taken.
Yeah.
And they were warned about this. The executive was warned. And I think SARS needs to hold the executive accountable. I think constitutionally they have a duty to do that. And, you know, I'm tired of these people coming on, we must all pay our tax and SARS will help us and it's our duty and we'll build South Africa. But they are giving the money to be squandered. And I think that is an absolute disgrace.
Yeah. Martin, let me give you an interesting stat here. Hopefully I can give it to you off air. Thank you so much for your comment there. Here's an interesting stat for you. This is research done by Bloomberg as well, saying, and this is just by Standard & Poor's alone itself, in 19 years, Standard & Poor's has downgraded 21 countries. Of those countries, only 6 have ever regained their investment grade status. So till this day, you still have at least 15 of those countries or so still sitting in non-investment grade. And on average, it takes about 5.5 years to get back your non-investment grade. The longest it's ever taken was Colombia, who lost their non-investment grade status on September 21st, 1999. And that was 11 years and 6 months in order to get back their investment grade status. So it doesn't bode well and doesn't paint a pretty picture for South Africa. But Soli from Tembisa has some thoughts on the new minister. Seems like we've lost Soli there. Michael, however, or is Soli still on the line? Not. All right, unfortunate there, but an interesting stat coming through. Please do give us a call, 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567 if you are in the Cape as well. We are getting a few calls coming in, and we'll hopefully take those. The likes of Latvia regaining their investment grade status on, I think, on May the 2nd, that was in 2012, taking them 3 years as well to get that far. We had Uruguay lose its investment grade status in the year 2002, and it took them what looks like 9 years and 5 months. So they're the closest to that 11-year barrier. It takes a very long time to get it back, and South Africa now have fallen into an unfortunate situation here, joining these countries, and it's now making it 22 countries having lost their non-investment grade status. One of the big countries as well, Greece, losing their investment grade status in 2010, still haven't regained it till this day. Barbados hasn't regained it till this day. Brazil, losing it on the 9th of September 2015, hasn't regained it. Neither has Russia, who, of course, choose probably not to subscribe to the ratings agencies themselves. 13 rand and 70 cents against the US dollar is where the rand currently sits. We saw earlier remarks by the former president, Kgalema Motlanthe, as well, saying that President Jacob Zuma must resign. These were calls from him earlier today, speaking as well to Bloomberg, having said as well that the situation in which he's put us in, and these are remarks by the former president himself, have been reckless and that they've ruined South Africa's credibility. And this then influences decisions by the ratings companies. Gordhan replaced, of course, last week by current finance minister Malusi Gigaba, who we had hoped would be on the show today, but sadly couldn't based on the data that has come out. We're hoping to get a statement out of
The National Treasury, that's Finance Minister Malusi Gigaba's office today, but hopefully we'll get something a little bit later. I think we have Alec from Johannesburg joining us on the line as well. Alec, your comment?
Hi, good evening. I just want to correct that previous caller who was criticizing Mark from SARS.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is there's no constitutional obligation on SARS in the first instance, but statutorily in the second instance. SARS is a revenue service. It is there to collect the revenue of South Africa. It
Correct.
Has no duty, no rights whatsoever nature to control the disbursement of those funds. That is why there has been this hijacking of Treasury.
Yes.
For that very reason. And I think South Africans need to understand that. And the only basis on which South Africans could control now, which is with what has happened, the disbursement of their funds and the utilization of their funds, is for an alternative tax boycott to take place, much in the way that ETOL has taken place.
Yeah.
However, it is critical not to create any kind of contagion that the public service, particularly the Defence Force and the police services and those other essential services, are not contaminated by this.
Yeah.
But it's that largesse, that excessive expenditure, unproductive expenditure, that needs to be reined in. And that is it. But that is the very reason why this has happened, because there are contracts being concluded, and I don't think it's a reach or circumstantial evidence or unsubstantiated evidence, like everyone likes to say, that there is sufficient evidence circumstantially under our law of evidence to establish that there is a reasonably grounded suspicion that the money is going to be squandered on corruption per se. But that said, I've heard the Adcock Ingram chairman say that corruption itself is not so bad as long as the money is spent and circulated in South Africa.
Yes, yes. Alec, thank you so much for your time there, man. A quick correction there on a previous call. George Glenos, Managing Director and also Chief Economist at ETM Analytics, joining us today. George, it can't be a great time for South Africa, but certainly expected, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm afraid it's not good news, Arabile, but as you quite rightly pointed out, this is hardly unexpected. I mean, we've been talking about this as an inevitability for the better part of a year now. And all that happened was President Zuma's decisions just proved to be the catalyst to bring that forward by at least, I would say, six to nine months, if not more. You know, I mean, just the timing of it all, it was so ill-advised and so ill-timed, especially when your finance minister, your sitting finance minister, is on a roadshow to prevent exactly this. And you recall him. I mean, you know, the timing couldn't have been worse. And, you know, one looks for a silver lining in all of this, and I would say the silver lining is that the rand hasn't been an absolute free fall. It's actually traded weaker, which means that quite a lot of this news was, in fact, priced in. And one hopes that it could be a catalyst for the removal of a person that hasn't covered himself in glory.
Yeah. Do you think this was considered, though, a thought towards something like this ever happening, you know, where we do get downgraded to non-investment grade, was considered when making the reshuffle?
Well, I mean, if it wasn't, even more reason why he should vacate his office. You know, I mean, this is an important development. It's We fought very hard as a country to get ourselves into investment grade in the first place. It took a lot of difficult decisions, a lot of hard work, a lot of restructuring of agencies like SARS in order to make that reality happen. And if effectively, through the course of the past 5 years, we've gradually deteriorated on the fiscal front to the point where we find ourselves now. And there's so much damage that's been done. One has to ask the question, how much investment have we not seen? Never mind the stuff that's leaving. How much have we not seen as a result of poor decision-making over a prolonged period of time? The hidden costs of interest rates that will just generally be a little bit higher now as a result of all of this. These are real costs that affect real businesses and real households. And it's very unfortunate that we now find ourselves in a position where, you know, our voter complacency, for lack of a better term, has led us to this point where we have not held our executive to account sufficiently, and where we now have to deal with the consequences of it.
George, then at the same time, what do we say with regards to getting back to investment grade? How long do you think that'll take us if we are able to get there, and what do we have to do?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely not impossible. We got there once before. We can get there again, but it's going to require a finance ministry with a tremendous amount of credibility. It's going to require efficiencies between the finance ministry, national treasury, and SARS. At the moment, we don't have any of that. We don't have the credibility, and that's just the base minimum of what you'll require in order to make the kind of decisions which would help and assist the country rectify its fiscal position and get ourselves to a point where we can start talking about ratings upgrades again. But that's going to require a tremendous amount of hard decision-making, and it will need, for example, government to slash its expenditure. It's going to need something close to a balanced budget for a number of years in order to pay down our debt pile. It requires quite a lot of effort now in order to regain what's lost. Yeah. And it's, again, you know, as you pointed out a little bit earlier, there are many countries that have slipped to junk status, in other words, sub-investment grade, and are still in it many, many years later. So it's a difficult decision to make, especially with a government that appears to have a tendency to be more socialist-minded, which tends to come accompanied with bigger government and large overheads that need to be funded by the tax base.
George, thank you so much for the time, man. George Glenos, who is the Managing Director and Chief Economist at ETM Analytics. More coming out of that decision by S&P to downgrade South Africa.
The Money Show.
Stock Pick Monday.
It is Stock Pick Monday. We almost forgot about such things. Hey, Byron, it's an interesting pick that you've got here. But before we get into that, how big a news is this?
Hi, Rebecca. Yes, I think you'll pick up from my stock picks that there is a big offshore and rand hedge theme, which I guess, you know, is a sign of the times at the moment. I know it's tough news to try and swallow because it sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, there's knee-jerk reaction on the rand. Everything gets immediately more expensive. And then, of course, you know, the cycle continues. So we're seeing debt will be a lot more expensive for the state-owned entities, and the knock-on impact is going to be pretty big.
Yeah. Naspers, so you say. I mean, last week we found out that Tencent, which is, you know, a company that Naspers does have a stake in, has a 5% stake in Tesla. So essentially giving Naspers a small portion as well there in Tesla.
Yes, we actually did the maths in the office, and Naspers' tiny little stake in Tesla is bigger than the entire market cap of Wolf and Bailey, which I think just puts things into perspective on, firstly, how small the construction stocks are at the moment, and, you know, how big Naspers is, as well as how big Tesla has become. In fact, I know we're going on a bit of a tangent here, but Tesla today, the market cap overtook Ford for the first time ever. And when you actually have a look at how many cars each of those companies produce, it's barely comparable.
Yeah.
But going back to Naspers, yes, there's not much access to big global tech for South African investors except through Naspers. But fortunately, it's almost an index on its own. You know, it's got so many underlying assets. It's not just Tencent, which, by the way, I think is a fantastic asset and really dominating with online gaming, which is a massive theme going forward. But, of course, they've got stakes in many, many online retail businesses around the globe, especially in the developing world. I mean, even, you know, we saw recently Amazon bought a online retailer in the Middle East had a small stake in the business. You know, they've got fingers in many pies all around the globe. And we can see how tech is changing our lives. And Naspers seems to be in all the right places with regards to global tech.
Well, Byron, I was hoping we could get through some of the others. You've got Bidcorp here as well, a spin-off then from Bidvest. We've also got Mediclinic. But sadly, I'm going to be crucified by Tara Penny if I don't get into the news. Hopefully, we can chat again a little bit later or some other time as well. Byron Lotter, Portfolio Manager at Vestec. Tara, your news. It's just gone 8 minutes past 7 o'clock. It's the Money Show it's the Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual. Do great things. Standing in for Bruce Whitfield. My name is Arabile Kumete from Bloomberg News. I hope you'll indulge me. We've now gotten
word from National Treasury, of course, now headed up by new Finance Minister Malusi Gigaba, who is in his fourth day in office. And I hope you'll indulge me. I'd like to read you out the statement. And this is how it goes. Government notes the sovereign rating announcement by S&P. While S&P has lowered its rating of foreign currency denominated debt to a sub-investment grade, Rand-denominated debt, which constitutes 90% of the debt portfolio, retains its investment-grade rating. Now, while the leadership of the finance portfolio has changed, government's overall policy orientation remains the same. As indicated by Minister Gigaba on 1 April 2017, government has been and will remain committed to a measured fiscal consolidation that stabilizes the rise in public debt. South Africa is committed to a predictable and consistent policy framework which responds to changing circumstances in a measured and transparent fashion. Open debate in a democratic society should not be a cause for concern, but reflects an important means to accommodate differing views. South Africa's constitutional arrangements remain robust. These key institutional strengths are acknowledged by ratings agencies. The rating announcement calls for South Africans to reflect on the need to sustain and act with urgency to accelerate inclusive growth and develop so that we can reverse the triple challenge of poverty, unemployment, and inequality. Reducing reliance on foreign savings to fund investment and relying less on debt to finance public finance expenditure will secure South Africa's fiscal sovereignty and economic independence. Government remains committed to making sure that its work with business, labor, and the civil society continues in order to improve the business confidence and implement structural reforms to accelerate inclusive economic growth. The Minister of Finance will engage further with the media tomorrow to discuss this outcome. Christy Fulyoun, economist at KPMG, joining us from Cape Town. The sun in Cape Town must be setting a little more darkly today.
Yes, this morning and this afternoon we were still looking at the possibility of eventually seeing a downgrade. This would have been probably in the beginning of June. That's when it would have been scheduled. And then this happened just this afternoon. So I think that after last week's happenings where there was already a dark cloud hanging, the thunderstorms are increasing, I guess.
Yeah. How far do we go then? Is this the last straw? Do we just go to one level below Jiang status? Or, you know, are there fundamentals in this policy uncertainty that could push us further? I mean, it seems easier to go further down than to get an upgrade.
Yes, there are many levels to still go down. Let's call it a table of different ratings. About halfway down, you get to non-investment grade where we are now. But there are still many ways to go down. There are lots of African countries further down the rating scale. S&P, after its downgrade, also said that it's still maintaining its negative outlook. And that's basically saying that, well, they still next move as downwards again. So this is certainly not the end. This is not the bottom. And yeah, then we have an of eventually going up, because getting back up is very difficult and it can take many, many years. It takes on average about 7 years to get back to your investment grade rating once you've lost it.
Yeah.
So there's no really a positive comment in terms of, okay, everything's fine now, let's just consolidate and get back up. This is certainly not the end in terms of where we can go lower and lower.
Yeah. Having done the research, I quoted it a little bit earlier, 21 downgrades in 19 years by Standard & Poor's, that is. So of those 21 downgrades, 6 regained their investment grade status. Only 6. South Africa has now fallen to that mark itself. On average, by the seams of things here, it'll take 5.5 years. But it took a country like Colombia 11 years and 6 months in order to regain its investment grade status. What does South Africa need to do to get its one back?
Well, from what I've seen in terms of research of countries that have lost the investment grade rating and returned back into that situation, it takes real effort. You either need to get support from outside, so maybe International Monetary Fund or World Bank, or you need to make changes domestically that have a big impact. Now, that means reforms to politics, economic policy, institutions, laws, all those kinds of things. There are a lot of options on the table, but you need to admit that you have a problem, and then you need to put in effort to rectify that. Now, if we just quickly look at what the Treasury just said in their statement, there's no acknowledgement that we have a big problem here. If you don't acknowledge the problem, you can't fix it. So I would say if we are looking at some kind of time frame for South Africa to get back to investment grade, it's going to be longer rather than shorter. It's going to take us longer before we get to the point where we make drastic changes and where we can move the country back into investment grade. That adds to the negativity at the moment, where over the past week, South Africans have had to deal with lots of different political issues. This is another push further down the slope where we are still heading downwards before we can get to a point where we see improvement.
Yeah. What happens to growth? What happens to interest rates? What happens, what happens holistically to South Africa from here on?
Well, the first impact that we're going to see is the rand is going to take a knock from this. And that means that imports are more expensive. That means that inflation stays higher for longer. That means that the Reserve Bank might have to respond with interest rate changes. For the ordinary South Africans, the quickest reaction we'll see is probably next month's fuel price. If things look very badly, fuel price will probably go up. For the government in general, it means that they would have to spend more money on interest, and that means money for building roads and building schools and those kinds of things. And when you take all of these together and all the negativity around this, business confidence and consumer confidence suffers. Businesses don't want to invest, consumers don't want to spend. And all of that together means the economy will suffer. It's definitely too early to talk about the idea of push us into a recession. It's too early for that. But it means that the weak growth that we have at the moment is stay with us for longer. And when we consider our country's challenges with unemployment, poverty, and inequality, we need economic growth to create jobs to solve those problems. Yeah. And with this happening, the pace of job creation will remain too slow to have a meaningful impact on our society.
Yeah. Do you think the other ratings agencies follow this announcement? I mean, we have Moody's scheduled for Friday as well, probably after market close. We don't know when Fitch will make its announcement. It doesn't have to adhere to a particular calendar. Do they follow?
Well, I guess the one positive thing to take from this is Moody's is still at the moment two levels above junk status. So if they decide to downgrade one level, then they are still, we're still actually in investment grade with them. Fitch has actually been on a negative outlook, similar to S&P, but for a shorter period. So they don't have the pressure that S&P is under to make a decision. Fitch have made a comment on Friday where they raised concern, they identified issues and problems that they have. So I think that they will probably wait until the beginning of June, where they are broadly expected to make an announcement. There's no real way of sugarcoating it. They can quite easily do a downgrade as well. And then they would also take South Africa into junk status. When you have two out of three rating agencies rating you below investment grade, that's basically, I don't want to say the nail in the coffin, but that's then official. Amongst international investors, you are considered to be non-investment grade.
And I mean, that puts us out of what is something that we joined not so long ago, really. It's called the WGBI, which is the World Government Bond Index, doesn't it? How important is that move?
Yes, that's important. It happened to Nigeria as well. They joined the index and they fell out again. By joining this index, it makes it easier for international investors to invest in your bond markets because for them it's a transaction system that they can easily get in and out of. Once you fall out of there, you lose the attention of some investors, you lose some of the money that they bring, and the effect of that is that interest rates on that kind of borrowing that the government does, those rates go up. We have to spend more on that. So this is definitely not good news. South Africa started in the 1990s with a sub-investment grade rating. And in the early 2000s, we got to investment grade. We went up, and up until about 2010, 2011, we did very well. And it's sort of been downhill ever since. So for us, the argument is that we've been in a good position, and there's been enough time for us to realize that we need to do something. So this could have really been avoided. If we wanted to make the effort, this downgrade into junk status could have been avoided, in my opinion.
Christy Fulyoun, economist at KPMG, thank you so much for the time there. More reaction coming through as well from the decision by S&P to downgrade South Africa to non-investment grade. The first time since the year 2000 that South Africa has returned to that mark.
The Money Show.
Business Books.
The Business Book feature is brought to you by FNB, introducing the innovative 48-hour cash accelerator investment account. It's more than just banking to FNB. That's why they help. Today's Business Book feature, ladders and trampolines, anecdotes and observations from a contemporary young African marketer. I don't know how you were able to fit all of that in, but Musa Kalenga joining us in studio today for our Business Book feature. How are you doing, having heard as well the news of S&P? Does that fare well for you?
I'm in shock and in horror. I mean, I've been in meetings the whole afternoon, so I'm hearing it for the first time. But yeah. Wow, what news to receive. Eh?
Yeah, certainly not good for South Africa. Tell us about yourself, Musa. Why have you decided to venture into what is now called contemporary marketing? What is that exactly?
You know, we always have these fancy terms in marketing just to confuse the masses. You know?
Yeah.
So I think I've always been a marketer at heart. I started my studies trying to tackle actuarial science, actually. So that's what I tried to do in my first year.
And found it was too difficult?
Well, I don't think it was too difficult. I wasn't focused enough. Let me just put it that way.
It sounds like me in accounting.
There was great ambitions. It sounded nice. But I think also I was not passionate about it. I mean, with hindsight, yeah, it would have been a very painful existence. But I was fortunate to have made a decision very early to then try and pivot into something that was more up my alley, suited my purpose, and that I thought I could add a lot of value in. And that's how I ended up in marketing. And it's literally evolved since then. So I started on the entrepreneurial side. I started a small business when I was at Wits with my cohort of 18 friends from all over the place, as one does. And since then, you know, it evolved. We went and we, you know, became a small medium enterprise. We did a merger with Brand Leadership. Then I did a little stint in corporate South Africa, which is also a big part of the book. I speak about some of my experiences.
Noticed that. Yeah.
So, and then, you know, nowadays, I think the big thing is understanding how marketing operates in a digital context. Yeah. And that's contemporary.
What kept your drive going? What kept you, you know, wanting to sort of break barriers and find out more, so to speak?
I think personally, I'm quite obsessed with the notion of value and adding value. Mm. You know, it's almost like a personal and a life philosophy. So for me, from a marketing perspective, what I saw as an opportunity for businesses to drive true value to their bottom line was something that I saw a lot of marketers not being able to grasp and to comprehend. So as a result, around boardroom tables, the marketing conversation is about colors and golf days and t-shirts and that kind of thing, whereas it should be a more strategic conversation. Because for me, marketing has always been about either getting more customers or getting existing customers to spend a lot more. Yeah. And that intrinsically is about creating value for a business. So my obsession with value is essentially what drove me down the marketing route. And as I said, that's something that's become a bit of a philosophy in business.
So if you were in the market, you'd pretty much be a value investor, is that what you're saying?
a very risky value investor.
All right. Well, earlier on, we had Byron with a few stock picks there. Perhaps you could take a look at those a little bit later. So tell us what inspires the book then. Ladders and trampolines. What exactly got you to write this?
There was a few things. Hey, I think the major itch for me was, I think maybe like a lot of African males that may go through a similar thing is, you know, I've got a father who I respect and I revere quite a lot.
Yeah.
But what I think was challenging for that generation of fathers was to often hand over some of their experiences to help understand some of the things that they went through. And I realized very late in my adulthood, well, not late, I'm still quite young, but I realized quite late that kind of thing was difficult to do, because now I'm now being a father and I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to hand over my lessons, my learning, my understanding to my son. So one of the things I wanted to do was capture that, so that one day, you know, when I'm here or if I'm not here, there's a reference point for my children to say, look, this is what my father went through. Secondly, I think the stories that I speak about is not anything unfamiliar to a lot of people that have gone through either corporate South Africa or have tried to start a business or have failed at a lot of stuff. But what I do think is that it actually just brings the element of it's okay to try some of these things and get them wrong. Yeah. And it's also okay for you to have a non-linear route route to success, which is, you know, which is often not necessarily the accepted way. You know, you got to be a junior manager before you're a senior manager. Yes. You got to be a senior manager before you're, you know, so that's literally where the ladder concept comes from. Whereas the trampoline concept is intrinsically about value. So you can be anything you want to be, provided you can add the value required. So so that's kind of where the itch came from. And then I started documenting these things over about 3 or 4 years, and eventually it came together, you know, as a book, which I then pulled together in a couple of weeks. Mm. And fortunately, I had a very brave publisher who said, "We want to hear your story, and we think you've got an important story to tell." So that's how it ended up there.
Let's delve more into the concept then of ladders and trampolines. Exactly as you said, the growth path with regards to ladders is quite systematic, right?
Yes.
And whereas with trampolines, it's just a jump up there. Would you liken that to anybody in particular?
I liken it to myself. I think that's the safest reference I can give.
Okay, fair enough.
So I think it's literally a mind state, right?
Yeah.
And it comes from the point of view that, to a great extent, a lot of young Black and African people and individuals are now educated, have got a primary degree, probably are the first line breadwinner and the ones that are going to break the poverty cycle in their generation. Mm. However, I think they're also constrained by this principle that you've done great, you've gone to UCT, you've gone to Harvard, and now you're a doctor, you're an accountant, you're whatever it is. Even within that success construct, you are still expected to be the next thing on the rung of your way up. And my view is, yes, that is okay, but it's not the best position, because even that is something that people consider as a bit of a trap. So, you know, you're just waiting for the next promotion, or you're trying to, you know, stick it out until someone retires and then you'll take their place. And some people are destined to be ladder people, and you know, no disrespect.
Yeah.
But the proposition here is that you do have a choice. You do have a choice. And fundamentally, that choice is, if you take higher risks, you get higher rewards. If you're able to be a trampoline individual who spots opportunities and contexts in the life and the career that you live, taking those risks has got a high reward. And with the same energy, you can achieve much more. So so I think that's the concept, and we're really passionate about pushing that onto especially younger entrepreneurs, younger Black and younger African children, so that they understand that it is an option.
You know, one of the biggest things that I think many, whether it be budding entrepreneurs, whether it be, you know, budding businessmen, or even people who work for corporates per se, would tell you is that finance is always a big issue.
Yeah.
Where they get their financing from, how they get it financed, etc. How do you move past that to become a trampoline kind of guy?
Yeah, so my experience is that I think there's no lack of money out there, is what I've discovered. So money is there, and it's plentiful.
I need to find the direction to that money, man.
I think the system makes it difficult to access the money in the way it's set up. So money typically sits in the hands of very few people. And because you don't necessarily have access to those people, it makes the perception that there isn't money available. But money is not the issue. What is the issue is having ideas that are sustainable and investable, and being able to get those ideas in front of the correct audience that will be able to give you the money. But financing, from what I've experienced, and I'm not, you know, and I'm no guru, but from what I've experienced, if you've got a value proposition and you're able to sell it to someone correctly, I think money is available. But we aren't creating confident enough young people that are able to define the value proposition and sell it confidently to someone that says, "I'm willing to back you." And I think that's what we need to spend a lot of time working on, is refining.
How do we create them? How do we create somebody confident enough to give an idea that could really be sustainable for 20 years and really become the next, whether Elon Musk or whatever the case might be?
It's I think it's systematic, and it's such a long game, you know, because there's so many aspects. The one aspect is we can't run away from education as a system in which we're teaching young children to adopt value and economics.
Yeah.
We can't run away from households as the smallest units of the economy. Within the households that we live, are we teaching our children to understand the value of being able to create and be able to put whatever they're creating into public market and being able to have that as bought? Our fellow Jewish brothers do that very well, and that's part of what they do from a cultural perspective. Mm. Whereas a young Black person, you don't necessarily have the same latitude to make mistakes, latitude to engage with business people and entrepreneurs, and we're still getting there. So I think the home is an important place to start. Then the schooling system, as I've mentioned, is designed to create more ladder people. It's not designed to create trampoline thinkers. Mm. And slowly but surely, we're getting kind of break-off sects of education that are saying, look, we need to be producing robotics engineers. We need exactly. producing, and those are the guys that typically think differently.
Yeah.
And then finally, when they get into the tertiary spaces, most of those tertiaries, as you know, are churning out people that maintain the status quo.
Yeah.
Accountants that keep the economy going, doctors that are in the hospitals, and I'm not dissing that, and I'm not saying it's not needed. But what I'm saying is the future that we're going into requires a fundamentally different skill set, and we are just not, from our homes to the schools that we send our children to, the educational institutions, we're just not creating them.
So the book is out?
Absolutely, yeah. You can get it at any exclusive books, CNA, Bookbound, any of the major retailers, and online on Amazon or iTunes as well.
Thank you for my copy. Ladders and Trampolines, Anecdotes and Observations from a Contemporary Young African Marketer, Musa Kalenga, joining us in studio then for our business book review.
The Money Show.
Make Money Mondays.
It's Make Money Mondays here on The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual. Do great things. Arabile Kumete standing in for Bruce Whitfield. I'm from Bloomberg News. Of course, the big news, as Tara Penny has said, S&P downgrading South Africa to non-investment grade. A big story there, considering that S&P has downgraded at least 21 countries in the last 19 years, with only 6 of them regaining their investment grade status. S&P saying that it's political uncertainty itself that has caused this downgrade. They're too worried about the future and just where policy might go for South Africa. But because it's Make Money Mondays, I'm joined by Elvis Blue. Now, you'll remember him as Idols winner, of course.
That's 2010. But yeah. I honestly think what should have happened this evening, it should have been like someone who writes horror movies or a death metal band. But here we are, Arabile.
But
here,
here's the perfect moment for a song, though.
Yeah, I'm thinking.
I don't know about you, but I mean, you can feature me on it too if you want.
There should be no talking this evening from any musician, only sad, sad music. Eh?
Yeah, look, it's an unfortunate situation, but what do you make of this?
Yeah, I think for me, just as a South African and yeah. as someone, everything I own is in South Africa. It's really heavy, but I think many of us, you know, become immune to heavy stuff. But this is just another thing, you know, that makes things difficult. Not only you, well, for all South Africans in the long run.
Yeah, certainly not the greatest story. I'm surprised to find that you have an average of 133 live performances a year.
Yeah, man. That's,
how come I've seen you probably 4 times?
That's what I do, man. I play music, you know, wherever people allow me to, and it's lekker, man.
Wait, hold on. So if we do the math in a situation like this, that's since 2010 you've won Idols, right? If we count up plus minus 133 performances since 2010, dude, you're sitting on at least a good, 800, 900 shows?
Absolutely, man.
Why? Don't you get tired of it?
Do you know what? I absolutely love making music. I've loved it since I was very young.
Yeah.
When I first picked up a guitar. And all I've ever wanted to do was to play and to make music. So I absolutely love. And I also really enjoy traveling, meeting people. So I'm really lucky. And people often ask me if you're tired of it, but not really. No, if I could do more, I would. But then when I get home, the dog would bark at me, you know. So you don't want that.
Sure. Yeah. Interesting career you've had. But at the same time, you've had to obviously deal with money issues along the way, right? And certainly how you deal with money, how you interact with money. And that's the point of Make Money Mondays. We choose and select anybody. They could be Kwaito stars. They could be pop idol winners. They could be politicians, even if we could get the chance.
If you could get them in studio.
Would be interesting to get Malusi Kigaba actually on and start talking there as well. But Elvis Blue joining us this evening. Elvis, tell us your earliest memory of money.
I remember my dad signing a check. What was fascinating?
Yeah, that was a long time.
That was a long time. Look, I'm 37 now. So it was years ago, but I remember, you know, being fascinated by a signature on a check in a shopping mall queue or something. You know, you're watching your dad.
Yeah.
And he looks so in control and his signature is so fast. But I just remember that was probably signing a check was my first recollection. My parents working with money.
Yeah.
That was probably my first recollection of money.
Is that also the one thing that may have shaped the way you viewed money? That you it gave you power, it gave you impetus?
Do you know what? My parents divorced when I was seven. Now, my biological dad is an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And he's been a millionaire and bankrupt many, many times. Oh. He's one of those really he's a crazy, crazy person. Okay. And he's very flashy and, you know,
Trump and he would share quite a few stories, probably. Yeah, but
he lives in America now, my dad, and I love him very much.
You sure he's not the president of the United States?
No, he's not.
Okay.
But, okay, he's always had a very cavalier approach to money. But my mom remarried, and she married Dominie Piet, a pastor. And so I grew up in a pastor's house. But now, look, this wasn't a pastor kind of with a fancy Mercedes. He's not one of those pastors, you know,
okay.
Mercedes,
yeah,
like
yeah.
Bodyguards. No, it was just, you know, but it was two opposites. So with my real dad, money was always, there was always just, it was very flashy and life was always very flashy. And then sometimes lots of panic about money and when it's not there. But in the pastor's house with my mom, the house I grew up with, we never had a lot of money, but they never ever seemed stressed about money, and they were always very much in control of money, and money never seemed to control them.
Yeah.
So I think they really had a big influence on the way that I view money.
Yeah, it's funny how the last time I did this feature, I featured somebody who you may know. I don't know if you interacted with him at all, but was Proverb.
Yeah,
now,
no, absolutely.
Of course, both of you are from that Idol stable. He's obviously still involved with it quite heavily. I don't know how much you still involved with it at all. And it seems that early childhood phase was really, really rather, made important by the same kind of people in a similar way.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, the question then was, who controlled the purse strings back at home?
Yeah, I think in the house I grew up with, my parents were always together.
Okay.
You know, so their finances, always together. And so there wasn't one particular person that I could say. My dad, I just always remember him budgeting very, very stringently.
Okay.
And going to the bank and having his books. And, you know, there was never any money lying around in the house, you know. And my mom always told me.
So nothing in the couches there?
No, nothing like that, you know.
Sure.
My mom always told me that I should never be someone who leaves money lying around, even if it's small change,
yeah. You
know. It's just, it's a way of life. I think it's important, you know. You should respect what you have and really treat it. My dad, even if he had 2 rand change in his wallet, he would know that, okay, so he's got 2 20s and a 2 rand. He
sure.
was that kind of, you know, but okay, not in a weird way. That was probably a bit weird.
Are you like that?
No, I'm not. And I have to work very, very hard not to leave money lying around. And sometimes if there's a 10 cents or 20 cents, you know, you kind of just,
yeah, it's just 10
oh,
cents.
Come
right?
on, it's such a mission, and my wallet is so full now. And,
yeah.
You know, but to kind
especially
of.
Especially with all these loyalty cards.
To remember that, you know. So, but they were always together, my parents, yeah. You know, with the money.
Was there always enough of it?
Oh, I don't think. Look, compared to who? If I had to compare it to my friends at school.
Yeah.
Definitely not, you know. I had sometimes had bread for school, and I had to make it myself with a little bit of jam. But then, of course, in South Africa, there are kids who have nothing for school. And then in my school, there were kids who, they were living it up, you know. So probably in the circles I was moving in, and not as much as the other kids, but I always felt very safe and as if there was enough. And my parents made sure that we felt that way.
What high school did you go to?
I went to Linden Worth School. I was here in Joburg. Yeah.
Okay, so Joburg born and bred?
Yeah.
Okay, all the way. Did your parents ever stress about money then?
I'm sure they did. Look, we were 5 kids in the house. And my dad was a dominie, you know. My mom was a piano teacher at home. So,
So
I'm certain that look, it wasn't always so easy. But like I said, you know, I never ever felt stress from them about money. I remember, you know, going on holiday, and like in the week of holiday, we would have one treat during that week. So you could go and buy an ice cream, but it had to only cost this much. You can buy an ice cream, it has to cost less than this amount.
Yeah.
So, but never stress, man. It was always, whatever we got was great.
Yeah. What's your earliest memory then of you earning that money?
Yeah, so look, when I was in high school, I wasn't getting enough pocket money, nearly. And my parents told me that, you know, you probably have to get a job. I was about 15 or 16, and I went wait to be a waiter. But I was a terrible waiter, probably for only a few weeks. And I actually got demoted as a waiter to being the clown at this place. You had to sing happy birthday and stuff.
Oh, wow.
And then my sister,
at
that time I had a guitar. And my sister told me that I should take my guitar to Rosebank, because they now had these pay points there. And if you go sit there and you play those two songs, you know, you can earn some money. And I took my guitar, and there were no other buskers at Rosebank. And the security was still like, what is this now, you know? And I earned so much money.
Oh, wow.
It was ridiculous.
What did you do with it?
I bought musicians, you know. You just buy more musical stuff, bought another guitar. And I lived it up, man. My other friends were the waiters at the Spur, man. I was like, hey, man, I'm playing music every weekend. So,
oh, it must have been so fun.
It was great, yeah.
All right. In the meantime, I'm just going to, cut this interview short just for now for a little bit. We're really going to get back to this. But we do have a caller on the line, Tulani from Centurion. What's your call about?
Hi, sorry. I just wanted to report that I was sitting in the house a minute or two ago, and I experienced a tremor. I think it lasted for at least a minute and a half.
Okay.
At the beginning, I just thought maybe it's my door rattling. Then everything started to move, my TV, the table where I'm sitting, and I didn't know even what to do.
It's a bad, bad day, guys.
It really is a bad day, isn't it? Gee, okay, Tulani, thank you so much. Anybody else in the Centurion area or anywhere else really across the country having felt a tremor as well, please do let us know. Yaku, or is it Jacko from Waverley as well, your comment?
Hey, Arabile, that's correct. I'm like sitting here watching the television and all of a sudden you just hear like this, you know, crazy tremor.
Yeah.
I think it lasted for about over a month. I'm in Waverley, Joburg. So I just to confirm what the previous caller said.
All right, so from Centurion right through to Waverley. Thank you so much there, Jacko. Roger as well, did you feel this tremor?
Just lying in the bed and watching ENT News, I felt my bed move up and down, and then I got up, I thought I was imagining it, or maybe there's an animal behind my bed pushing it. But then I went to my wife who was in the lounge, she also felt it, and she was also scared, because her couch was moving up and down. And suddenly we realized it's a tremor.
Yeah. Well, we certainly didn't feel anything else from this end, but please do keep them coming. Do also send me your tweets, your SMSs as well. Let me know if you're feeling any sort of tremors, anything sort of happening as well, and we can hopefully get down to that as well. And hopefully we'll get some officials detailing exactly what has just happened. We're still carrying on with Make Money Mondays in just a little bit after this.
On 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567.
It is Make Money Mondays, 10 to 8 o'clock on this Monday evening, where we were downgraded officially by Standard & Poor's to non-investment grade. That's junk status, the first time since the year 2000 that South Africa lost its investment grade. Just a few of your tweets here as well coming through from Raphael Ascendon, who says, cry, Arabile, cry for the voting sheep that even now remain defiant in supporting Zubta, hashtag brainwashed. Another one, Naza, saying, I just felt a tremor in Randburg. I'm sitting in my car and it suddenly started shaking for about a minute. Somebody as well saying, yep, Arabile, I just experienced a young tremor in New Mirkelneck in Pretoria, Tieto. I enjoyed the interview then with Musa Kalenga as well. What a bright individual. Please do keep them coming. Your tweets, SMSs, as well as your phone calls. I've got Tsekhwane also on the line. Tsekhwane, what's going on your end?
Yeah, I'm in Bryanston. There were vibrations here.
Yeah, also feeling vibrations as well from that side.
Yeah, they were longer than in the morning. In the morning it happened, and I woke up and I felt the vibrations. Now I saw my plate was in front of me, and I was like, what's happening? It kind of like felt good, but scary when you start applying your mind to it.
Yeah. All right.
And it was a bit long now, compared to in the morning.
So I know in the morning they weren't sure whether that was from mining activity. So hopefully we can get some more clarity exactly. I'm not entirely sure if we've actually had anything come out from any officials regarding what happened earlier today. And particularly now then feeling a tremor. Of course, South Africa going through some torrid times, and Elvis suggesting that we're going through a really tough time here. But we still do have Make Money Mondays. Elvis Blue joining us, former Idols winner in the year 2010. It feels like an age ago now, doesn't it?
Well, it is 7 years, eh?
Yeah, sure. Wow, 2010. That was also when we hosted the World Cup. So you were part of the feel-good story. How does that make you feel?
Yes. Well, it was nice to be part of that feel-good story. Hopefully we can have one again.
Yeah. Elvis, what was the first investment you made?
It was probably when I got married and we had our first, we had our daughter. Just a retirement annuity, something like that, and to prepare for her studies immediately when we had her. That was my first like serious investment, signing a whole bunch of stuff, you know. I was about 26, 25 years old.
At that point, it finally hit you that, okay.
Yeah, and obviously a car was investment, but I mean, that was probably the first serious one.
Yeah. What did you do with, at what age did you have your first bank account?
I had my first bank account when I was 15 years old. I went to boarding school.
Okay.
In Potchefstroom, which is a dangerous place, you know. I went there and I had to have a bank account so that I can buy food and stuff like that. So I was 15 years old when my parents opened a bank account for me.
Sure. It couldn't have had too much money, though, in it. I'm sure they were trying to tie you up with those purse strings, right?
What I remember about having a bank account is standing at the ATM, like hoping that somehow like there was a mistake. Someone made a mistake. And if I type in this PIN right now, something's going to happen, you know, at that stage of my life.
Yeah. What was your first paying job? Was it the one where you ended up becoming
busking.
A clown?
Busking. It was being a street musician was my first paying job. And my first proper paying job was also just being a musician. Mm. After that, you know, getting a job at a restaurant where one of the restaurant owners saw me being a street musician and said, hey, well, I can pay you a little bit and give you some food if you come and play at my restaurant. And I kind of took it from there.
That clearly then paved the way for your career choice, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I've never really done anything else other than music. Sure. So I was really lucky that way. Mm. I studied music after school, went to study, and at that stage, I was also doing gigs and just playing and trying to make it.
Yeah. And did you then think to yourself that having gotten this far, how much more help will my parents be able to give me? Did they accept the choice you had made?
My parents were really good to me, eh? Even though they didn't have tons of money, I remember my stepdad waking me up one morning, taking me to a music shop. When I told him that I wanted to go and study music, taking me to a music shop and telling me, look, man, they really want to help me to get what I need so that I could go and study. And I know they didn't, they weren't really able to afford that, but they did that, you know, anyway. So my parents were always very, very supportive of what I wanted to do and of the music that I wanted to do, yeah.
Mm. Having made all those choices, what was the best money decision then you think you've made thus far?
Do you know what? I think probably the best money, it's a weird one because at the time I thought it was a very terrible money decision. But okay, we were talking earlier about Idols. When I did that, the prize was a bunch of stuff, a car, et cetera, but also it was 500,000 rand.
Oh.
And And myself, and when there were only two people left in this competition, myself and a guy called Lloyd Trele,
we made a deal
that we would split the money.
Yeah.
So that it would be a guaranteed 250,000 instead of a gamble on half a million.
So you hedged your bets.
We did. And what happened was, so when I was lucky and I won, and okay, so
did you want to take back that decision?
No, actually, no.
Well, you can tell us now. It's 7 years on.
It's half a million. But okay, a deal is a deal, you know. And so we split the money.
Yeah.
But then what happened was the weirdest thing. Giving that money away, it bought us so much press. Just that thing that happened there.
Yeah.
Was worth much more than the 250,000 rand that you get. It was actually, someone actually calculated the amount of press was in the millions.
Gee.
So giving that away was probably the best money decision I've ever made.
That's crazy. I don't know how many people would agree with you on that one and say, you know, I'm going to give away 250,000 rand to get back.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
But you know, sometimes
so
you got to go with your gut.
Yeah.
And that usually, that's probably the best thing to do.
What's your worst ever decision then?
You know what? I once started a business. I was really battling with music. And my wife and I, we started a handbag business. It was like this, we knew someone who could weave. And we had this material and we thought we could make these beautiful handbags.
Yeah.
And so there's this festival called Kaka and Ka in Oudtshoorn. It's this big, big arts festival, lots of stalls. And we took our handbags there. I think I made 300 handbags.
Sure.
And we put all our money into it. And I thought this was going to be it, man. When people see these handbags, they're going to freak out. And in the end, I think after 5 days, I'd sold 4 handbags.
Wow.
It was heavy, man, listening and sitting there listening to all the other artists performing, thinking, what the hell are you doing? It's probably the worst money decision.
Started from the bottom, now we're here. Look at you, Elvis Blue, joining us today on what is Make Money Mondays as we talk about his journey with money. He's joined us in studio and really told us and detailed really just his start with money and his journey and just how that's gone for him. We are keeping up with a few of your tweets as well. Hopefully we'll get more reaction on that. It just felt a tremor in Birch Acres for a minute. That's according to Justice Mta. Mavi as well just felt another seismic activity at Rustenburg about 10 minutes ago. So it is seemingly quite well spread out. Hopefully we can get to that. South Africa getting downgraded to non-investment grade as well today. Not a good look for South Africa from S&P. Hopefully we'll get the others who won't follow through. But the story continues. I'll see you tomorrow. It's been fun. It's been great. That is The Money Show with me, Arabile Kumete from Bloomberg News.